is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There was a strong focus on concerns about COVID-19, about the socioeconomic impacts of the disease on communities, on societies in Africa. The financial impacts are hurting everybody. Children are out of school. We're not just seeing that in Africa. We're seeing that everywhere.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir on African leaders speaking virtually at the UN General Assembly on the primary topic, COVID-19. Details coming up. Also, ECOWAS calls the appointment of a civilian prime minister in Mali a welcome development. And the U.S. Embassy in Malawi says it is deeply saddened that two daughters of Deputy Defense Minister John Sindezi have been shot, one fatally, in the U.S. state of Indiana. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. African diplomats have addressed the issue of terrorism, climate change, and development in their virtual speeches to the UN General Assembly. But like the rest of the world, they have primarily focused on fighting COVID-19 and dealing with the impact. International edition Steve Miller spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir about the annual discussions.
Well, I think some of the main themes we saw in not just African leaders' speeches, but in most world leaders' speeches, there was a strong focus on concerns about COVID-19, about the socioeconomic impacts of the disease on communities, on societies in Africa. The financial impacts are hurting everybody. Children are out of school. We're not just seeing that in Africa. We're seeing that everywhere, but it's definitely a concern there. There's also the issue of climate change. That's been an ongoing concern for Africa. They raise it repeatedly at the General Assembly. They're one of the parts of the world that contributes the least to carbon emissions, but they suffer the worst from it. And we're seeing it especially this year with exceptional numbers of floods and droughts and the locust situation in East Africa. This is all attributed to climate change. So there was definitely the theme of climate action running through their speeches. And then there's the conflict aspect and humanitarian issues across the continent. A lot of concern from leaders about the situation in the Sahel, a lot of concern about Libya and how Africans are going to Libya to migrate across the Mediterranean, and they're getting caught up in this conflict there. They're being detained. There's also the concern about the flow of arms from Libya south into the continent, because that's one of the main sources of fuel for other problems on the continent, on the subcontinent. The weapons are, there's just a wash. Libya is awash in weapons from all sources, and many of it goes through its porous borders and down into the hands of rebels and others in conflicts in other parts of the continent, like Mali, for instance. So these were all subjects that were raised over and over again. And terrorism, of course, the issue of terrorism you have in all parts of the continent from groups like Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram and others. So there was a lot of concerns.
Unlike past UNGA meetings where people have been in the building to meet face-to-face on the sidelines, this is all taking place virtually. So, how are these messages being received? And is any movement being done on taking up these issues and moving forward, since people don't have the opportunity to meet while there?
Well, it's sort of two parts. Like you say, nobody's there to hear it particularly. The hall of the General Assembly is filled with mostly ambassadors, and it's very limited, one ambassador from each country. So we don't have a lot of people in the building. But at the same time, these aren't new problems, and the leaders of major powers are aware of what's going on in Africa, and the leaders of countries with influence in the region are aware. And, it's unfortunate, though, because the General Assembly on the sidelines of it typically is a real opportunity for Africa, because there are a lot of meetings like on issues. For instance, you'll have a Libya group meeting or a Mali meeting or a South Sudan meeting. Last year, Sudan and its transition was basically the highlight of the UN General Assembly week, because we had the new prime minister, Hamdok, and it was really finally some sort of success on the continent that people were celebrating. So it got a lot of attention. But this year, Africa's kind of slipped under the radar. I think everything has really slipped under the radar. It's really COVID focused. And it's just hard to get points across when people are doing them on videotape.
That was VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. A spokesperson for the Economic Community of West African States calls the appointment of a civilian prime minister in Mali a welcome development. The military junta named 64-year-old former foreign minister Mokhtar Ouane as interim prime minister yesterday, who will serve during an 18-month transitional period. ECOWAS has made the appointment of a civilian prime minister one of the prerequisites for lifting regional sanctions. Dr. Adermi Ejibewa, ECOWAS's director of political affairs, says Ouane is an astute and intelligent diplomat and that his appointment as prime minister is encouraging. However, Ejibewa says there is still more to do before sanctions are lifted. Burundi's president last week told the United Nations the foundations exist for a strong democracy in the country, but human rights groups aren't so sure. Evariste Ndayishimiye was elected in May after the death of Pierre Nkurunziza, whose 15-year rule was characterized by political violence. The fledgling president says Burundi is now stable, calm, and entirely under control. Recent rebel attacks say otherwise. Darren Taylor reports.
Burundi has been unstable and violent for almost three decades, ever since the assassination of newly elected president Melchior Ndadaye. This ignited ethnic violence between Hutu and Tutsi factions and the beginning of the Burundian civil war. Veteran human rights activist Marie-Louise Barikako says whatever the new president says, present-day Burundi is still a case of the government and its loyalists committing crimes against the people.
Violations of human rights, killings, arbitrary arrest and detention, so many things, including rape and gender-based violence, economic crimes and all those. And all these and many more have been committed either by or under the supervision of the National Security Services.
Barikoko is the chair of the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security in Burundi. She appreciates that the Ndayishimiye administration is acknowledging and condemning corruption and brutality, but says actions must follow the words. Barikoko says it's the ruling party's youth wing, known as the Imbonerakure, who remain particularly vicious.
There is a golden opportunity today for the new president to break with the past and take a clear stand to order immediately and publicly the Imbonerakure militia to stop all their illegal practices. This is possible.
The president continues his calls for refugees to come back home, but accompanied by a statement that those who worked with the country's enemies will have to be corrected first.
Those he was talking about are us, who denounce and keep the world informed of what is happening in the country. Now that they have noticed what we have been denouncing, before punishing those who spoke about the crimes, they should first punish those who committed them.
Ndayishimiye says the recent return of some refugees is a clear demonstration that the nation's becoming peaceful. Barikoko claims it's much too early to say this, and most refugees are still choosing to remain elsewhere.
If we count those who are in Rwanda, Tanzania, DR Congo, Uganda, and those who are in Kenya, in Mozambique, in Malawi, South Africa, Zambia, and those who were in Tanzania before 2015, we have 507,000 refugees.
Her contention is that the president cannot justifiably say Burundi is stabilizing when there are still more than 4 million people out of a population of around 12 million who need humanitarian assistance. Barikoko maintains the only way forward for her country is through the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement. It was signed in Tanzania in 2000 and, on paper at least, ended the civil war.
Everything was provided for in the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement. Unfortunately, CNDD-FDD regime failed to consider the implementation of the Arusha Agreement as their primary mission and their best chance for long-term peace and stability in Burundi.
She says the terms of the treaty must become reality if Burundi is ever to thrive. But she sees little to suggest that President Ndayishimiye is prioritizing it.
You cannot continue to cover up the issues, not really bring solutions, and hope to have the new Burundi we want to build that developed and prosperous Burundi we need.
Barikoko appeals to the new government not to abandon the agreement in favor of seeking absolute power and revenge, which she says are what have brought Burundi to the edge of destruction. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Rival Libyan factions will resume their dialogue in Morocco tomorrow in an attempt to resolve their country's crisis. The second round of talks between the High Council of State and East-based Parliament was supposed to be held yesterday, but was pushed back due to disputes over the agenda. In 2015, Morocco hosted the initial Libyan dialogue that produced the Libyan political agreement of Sikhart, which created the UN-backed government of National Accord. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi spoke with former U.S. envoy for Libya, Jonathan Winner, whether this new round of dialogue could lead to another agreement.
In 2015, the whole world saw the prospect of what would happen if the Islamic State took over Libya. It established a beachhead in Sirte. It expanded it, bisecting the country at the coast. It began executing Egyptian cops. They put in orange jumpsuits and cutting off their heads. Everyone was seeing that. I think that concentrated people's minds, and they recognized that a divided Libya would fragment into a terrorist haven. And that allowed the Sikhart Agreement to happen with the support of essentially every relevant actor. After the Sikhart Agreement happened, we had very bad behavior by Russia in Libya, where Russia began putting in billions of dollars worth of counterfeit dinars to enable Khalifa Haftar to build a patronage system, which he used to build out his army. And in 2016, his representatives and sons told me he would invade Tripoli by the end of the year. Now, in 2020, there is still Islamic State risk, and there's Al-Qaeda risk and other terrorist risk. We've also seen that the effort by Haftar to conquer the country did not work, and conquest is not going to bring a solution to Libya. Power-sharing arrangements compromise democratic institutions that meet the needs of the people, particularly at the local level. That's what's going to provide solutions. The foreign backers all need to recognize that they can't win Libya. Libya is not going to wind up with an Egyptian-controlled government or with a Turkish-controlled government. And partition won't work either. The oil transects the country. You can't divide up the country and keep the oil flowing. So as people begin to recognize that there are geopolitical limits to anybody achieving victory, they can hopefully then get back, having been exhausted by war, to reaching agreements, both among the international actors to accept a negotiated settlement and by the Libyans to negotiate one. And that's what needs to happen. And having Morocco host such meetings can help make it happen.
On top of the Libyan dialogue hosted by Morocco, there has been another track in Switzerland sponsored by the UN, and Egypt recently hosted a meeting between the Speaker of the Parliament, Aqila Saleh, and Commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, and insisted that the so-called Cairo Declaration is the best roadmap for stabilizing Libya. How would these tracks lead to a political solution in Libya?
Well, last January in Berlin, all the major countries involved in Libya reached an agreement how the Libyan peace process would go ahead. And there are a variety of locations for talks and types of talks, including what's called 5+5 talks on the military track, to see what kinds of agreements can be reached between the respective militaries of Khalifa Haftar and that of the Government of National Accord. But in the end, there have to be economic talks, political talks, and military talks. Those are the three big buckets. They're broken down into a variety of other areas. You've got talks on elections, when to hold elections. Sometimes there are talks having to do with interim arrangements for governance. They all just need to keep going. with the UN at the center of organizing it as the neutral facilitator rather than any individual country taking the lead. Having them take place in Morocco has been wonderful because Morocco has been seen as having a light touch and being an excellent host. Switzerland is another appropriate place for such talks. You can have special one-time talks, as happened back in 2015 and 16, 14, in places like Rome and Paris and Berlin and London and even Washington. But none of those countries should be capturing the leadership role because that inevitably starts tilting the talks one way or another. And so the efforts from time to time of Turkey or Egypt or the Emirates to take the lead, those aren't going to work. Those countries' assent is going to be absolutely essential. They're going to have to be part of any agreement. So there's a lot of orchestration going on behind the scenes. I'd like to see the orchestration go from limiting the war to completing a ceasefire and moving ahead much faster, negotiations that lead to a stabilizing peace. It's doable, but only if everybody's lined up and cutting back on their demands. Libya can produce enough wealth to take care of everybody in the country, to rebuild the cities, to build new institutions and capacities and infrastructure in the south, to move ahead replacing the water system and the great man-made river, which is in need of being updated, updating the oil infrastructure so Libya can produce more oil and more wealth for its people. All of that can happen with reasonable political leadership and support from the internationals.
That was former U.S. envoy for Libya, Jonathan Weiner, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The U.S. Embassy in Malawi says it is deeply saddened that two daughters of Deputy Minister of Defense Jean Sindeza have been shot, one fatally, in the United States state of Indiana. The embassy statement offered its deepest condolences to Deputy Minister Sindeza and her family for the death Friday of her daughter, Nora. The Associated Press reports that a 37-year-old man named Kalikini Lindiri from the Indiana town of Mishawaka has been arrested and faces charges in the fatal shooting of Nora Matambalika and the wounding of Munda Glory Sindezi, who were found in an overturned car in Mishawaka. Nora later died in the hospital. Lindiri is expected to appear before a judge today. As South Africans start rebuilding their lives from the devastating effects of COVID-19, some are venting their anger on foreign nationals and demanding they leave at once. A group calling itself Put South Africa First is embarking on a series of marches to embassies and government offices, accusing foreigners of committing violent crimes, sex slavery, kidnappings, human traffickings, and drug sales. Tusoko Malo reports from Johannesburg.
The only one South Africa group is emphasizing that foreign nationals have no business in South Africa and are not welcome. While some members have limited their protest marches to illegal non-nationals, others are making it clear South Africa is for South Africans only. Last week, the group marched to the Nigerian and Zimbabwean embassies, giving them 3 months to ensure all criminals from their nationals are gone. Nandisa Shwari is one of the organizers of the marches.
They are allowed to say it's xenophobic if that's how they feel. I cannot stop them. Look, Nigerians, they are known to be the top of the list. Yes, they are South Africans. I don't know how many cases I've got in Midrand regarding drugs and then human trafficking. But nothing is happening. The Nigerians are just paying them to do as they like.
And another member of the group, Ike Kumalo, says they can no longer agree to give foreign nationals equal share of rights and resources.
Everything that we want, they want. So there is no manifesto that can work. Our constitution is a problem. There is no constitution that can say everyone. Who is everyone? The constitution should say a South African. To just go to a failed state like Zimbabwe, you cannot do what Zimbabweans are doing here.
Nigeria's ambassador to South Africa, Karibu Bala, has not taken the accusations kindly.
We are being unnecessarily targeted. I don't think the crime that is being committed here are committed by Nigerians alone. There are other foreign nationals who are committing crimes here. But everyone who cares to read history knows what Nigeria has done to this country.
Frans Viljoen, director of the Center for Human Rights at the University of Pretoria, says the group's actions could stoke another round of xenophobic violence if not checked.
That campaign essentially is based on a series of generalizations which essentially then give rise to a stigmatization of particularly Nigerians and Zimbabweans in South Africa. There's a quest to look for a blame, scapegoats, and that's inappropriate and unproductive, we say.
South Africa has experienced a string of xenophobic violence since 2008. A number of those started with poor government service delivery protests and negative sentiments on foreign nationals on social media. Last month, a scathing report from the Human Rights Watch group found that government officials and police have contributed to violent xenophobic incidents that have left dozens dead, hundreds injured, and thousands displaced. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The U.S. has announced a $152 million in new aid to Africa's Sahel region in an effort to support the strategically important but fragile region. VOA Salem Salamon has the story.
The U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel, J. Peter Pham, announced the humanitarian aid on Thursday following a trip to West Africa where he visited Mauritania and Niger. The Sahel is plagued by extremist violence, a harsh and changing climate, and political instability. During a conference call hosted by the Wilson Center's Africa program, Pham said the U.S. has a continued commitment.
More than 2.5 million people in the Sahel region are displaced. 3.3 are in need of humanitarian assistance and protection services. And the United States is proud to be the largest donor of humanitarian assistance to the region.
The funding will assist some of the most vulnerable populations in Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. The assistance will not go to the Malian military officers who recently took power in a coup. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also explained where the fund will go. Significant gaps in meeting humanitarian needs, in addition to environmental concerns such as major flooding across the region, have been further exacerbated during the COVID-19 pandemic, he said in a statement. Pompeo said that programs funded by the aid will provide jobs, shelter, healthcare, food aid, drinking water and hygiene services to people at risk. More than 4,000 people died in terror attacks in the Sahel in 2019, making it the deadliest year on record for extremist violence. A military coup in Mali this year threatened to further destabilize the country, beset by violence since last military coup in 2012. And Niger is being hit with historic flooding that has left 330,000 homeless. Pham said he was struck by seeing the height of the Niger River and the submerged structures.
If displacement by conflict weren't enough, we now have historic flooding with unprecedented rains across the region. You know, this is a region where water was greeted with elation, and now it's turned the other way around.
Issues of food security and poverty in the region are closely linked to personal security, since violence has led to mass displacements in several countries. Approximately 5.5 million people suffered food insecurity in the region this summer in what is known as the lean season, the World Food Program reported.
I would say for the ordinary man, woman, and child, the key issue in their daily life is security and livelihood. This has always been a fragile region, and in recent years it's only, unfortunately, grown even more fragile, and it hangs by a very narrow thread.
Pham said despite the daunting challenges, there is some cause for optimism on the political front. In Niger, President Mahamadou Issoufou says after his second term in office is complete this year, he will step aside to make way for a peaceful transition of power.
When that occurs in Niger, it's going to be the first ever in the country's history of an elected president ceding power to whoever is elected his successor. That's a historic moment in the country's history, and it's a good sign. It's another, if you will, good characteristic to be encouraged. Democratic and inclusive government can be a bulwark against the further spread of violence. And that's why we're pressing for free and fair elections this year in Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Ghana, and next year in Benin.
Pham added he hopes this serves as a model for other countries on the continent. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abbaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing